Hello, my name's Kate Rolls and I'm interviewing you for the Wellcome Trust as you're taking part in Anthony Gormley's new artwork, One and Other. The date today is the 9th of August 2009 and the time is 11:20 a.m. If I can please ask you to state your full name, your date of birth and where you come from.
My name is Stephen Hopkins. I was born on 31st of July 1951 and I live in Herefordshire in a small village called Clodoch.
And you live in Herefordshire. Where are you from originally?
I was born in Romford in Essex.
Okay. And you're here today to stand on the fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square as part of this project. What was it that motivated you to apply to be part of this work? Why did you decide to do that?
I've been aware of Anthony Gormley's work for quite a long time, most obviously in terms of The Angel of the North, but also some of the things he's done elsewhere. I'm interested in art, have been involved in various art projects and theatre pieces for a long time. Trafalgar Square is a place that I have associations going back through my childhood, and indeed before I was born, my mother and grandmother posed here for a photograph during the war. So I have a lot of strands that connect me to this. So when the opportunity arose, in fact, even before the opportunity arose to put my name down, I tried to put my name down. And then when it came about that one could, I did, and here we are.
Great. And when you found out that you had got a place on the plinth, how did you decide how to use your hour up there?
Well, the first thing I found out was that I hadn't got a place on the plinth. So that was interesting to be told, sorry, you've not been successful this time, and to think, damn. And then when I got an email saying I had been selected, I thought, damn, so what am I going to do? So I asked a lot of people what they thought I should do, and that was very interesting. And obviously I thought about it a lot. And I read, the most influential thing I read was Tom Lubbock's piece in The Independent, his early report, Art Criticism of the Plinth, in which he talked about people doing things and people not doing things, although that's an artificial divide in many ways. He talked about the value of stillness, and particularly referring to the coffee pot that was an early feature of the internet, the coffee pot in the Cambridge lab, that people just tuned in to see whether it was full or empty. Not that they might necessarily have been able to get any coffee out of it, they might have been a million miles away, but it became a kind of talking point and people thought, well, why would you want to just watch a coffee pot? And that was the beginning of a kind of, so here's an art form in the internet age, which is slightly different. Sculpturally, of course, sculptures don't generally move. So that's interesting from the point of view of being alive, to be on a plinth and to move or not move. Well, it's impossible not to move at all. But it's interesting to maybe try to be still. So that's what, after a long process, I thought. But I also felt that only to be there for me was too selfish, and that I needed to, in the spirit of one and other, to reach out to the other. And in this, in my case, it's both Tibet and Burma, causes that are close to my heart, that I would like to make some gesture of support toward, without turning my entire hour into a piece of political proselytizing.
So you're going to be still for an hour on the plinth, is that right?
Relatively still. I'm pretty sure I won't manage absolute stillness, and that's not my intention. But stillness rather than, say, a performance or an activity of which there have been many, many kinds on the plinth. I'm not a performer. I'm not an artist. It would be foolish to pretend that I was either. And one of the things about getting a place on the plinth is that it sure encourages you to think about how foolish you could actually look.
Is particular stance that you're going to take in your stillness?
Physically, you mean?
Yes.
Standing, not sitting.
Okay.
Although I'm not promising not to sit, but but essentially standing, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And would you like to speak a little bit about the causes, the Tibet and Burma, that you would like to send a message to today?
Yes. As I said before, the reason for not simply standing there or being on the plinth without indicating support to something is that it felt to me to be too insular and selfish and so on to not do that, which isn't a criticism of people who choose to go that way. I think that's fine if that's what you want. But for me, both Tibet and Burma have been important influences in my life, and both, I think, need our help at this time and have needed it for a long time. And so this is an opportunity to at least put that front and center in my hour to a degree. And the difference between the two being that in the square, of course, there's a statue of Henry Havelock, who fought in the First Anglo-Burmese War. So there's an interesting link there. And my father served in Burma during the war. So there's an interesting link there for me. And I have visited Burma, so that is also interesting. And as we know, as we speak, Aung San Suu Kyi is awaiting sentence in Burma. She's been under house arrest for many years now, but she may now be put into jail, which will exclude her from the forthcoming elections, which means that Burma, if all that comes to pass, looks like it will continue in the rather parlous and troubled way it's been. That's Burma. Tibet, well, you know, I'm a child of the 60s. The Dalai Lama has been a great influence in my life, or his example has been a great interest. Not that I would have any pretense of being anything like him, but the Tibetan diaspora has been a very important influence in many of our lives and continues to be. And of course, what is happening in Tibet is very serious. The destruction of a culture, the dispersal of a people, this doesn't look like it's going to get any better. It looks rather like it's going to get worse. So again, it's an opportunity to say, okay, here's Tibet, just remember.
Okay, thank you. And could I ask you to articulate perhaps a little bit about the situation in Tibet as you understand it briefly, just for historical purposes?
Well, of course, it's very involved, and the British are as much a player in this as other nations are, and one could say that our invasion under Young Husband destabilized the place, and that was the forerunner to the Chinese taking over a part of the world that they, when they make their case, say has always been a part of China, and Tibet, of course, always maintains that it's been an independent entity, and there's all sorts of legal international wrangling about these things. Okay. I think whatever one's position is on the rights and wrongs of China's claim to sovereignty over Tibet, what is actually happening to Tibetan culture, and in particular to Tibetan Buddhist culture, is that it's clear that monasteries and monks and nuns and the visual and written record of that culture has been systematically removed, is being systematically removed, not only in Lhasa around the Patala, but in other places too. And we've seen, or we saw at the time of the Olympics, widespread rioting and unrest, the extent of which is very hard to judge because of the difficulty of getting accurate information out under the Chinese. So we know that there is a destruction of a traditional culture there, which has or had many difficulties in relation to women's rights and so on. I wouldn't pretend that Tibet before China was a paradise, but what I would say is that it had a right or has a right to a sort of self-determination and peaceful coexistence, which it would appear is not being honoured. The dilution of the Tibetan culture by the large-scale migration of Han Chinese, by the creation of rail links, the exploitation of Tibetan mineral reserves, all of these things are further solidifying the power of China within Tibet. The efforts of the Dalai Lama and his cabinet to negotiate with the Chinese have not borne any fruit, and one has to question the degree of good faith with which the Chinese negotiated. So, on the whole, within Tibet, not a good picture. Outside Tibet, Tibetan culture has spread and permeated to an extent that would probably have been unthinkable had it remained within its borders. This, in my view, is a good thing, but the price is very high.
Thank you. And we've spoken now about your causes and about your motivation for taking part in the project and what you're going to do. I'd now like to ask about you. Who is that person on the plinth today?
Well, who's the person on the plinth? Who's the person in the chair? Who's the person speaking into the microphone?
Yes.
I don't think we have to become very metaphysical to wonder what the answer to those questions are, what any of our answers to those questions are, and particularly for anyone who spent a lot of time looking at them, they're rather imponderable and mysterious. But the bare facts, okay, you know, 58 TV producer living in the countryside, stable partnership, vegetable gardener, interested in the arts, long-term commitment to meditation practice, working in Zen Buddhism, working with a Javanese movement teacher, working in Tai Chi. Those are the some of the outward parameters. Mother and father and sister living in Norfolk, near where Nelson was born. Here we are, Trafalgar Square again. Long associations with London. Who do you make out of that? It's up to you. Your judgment is as good as whoever I might call myself.
And which of those elements would you like to elaborate on, if any?
I'd like to elaborate on them all, but we don't have world enough and time. I think the interesting thing about being asked to or being given a place on the plinth is that it does or has caused me to reflect on those things in a different kind of way, because of course being on the plinth is a performance, but then sitting here in the chair speaking to you is a performance, or going down to the bakery and buying a loaf of bread is a performance. It's all a performance, and at the same time it's all the real thing. There's no difference. So what is different about being on the plinth? Nothing. It's just higher up and more visible. So this is an interesting opportunity for me. This is the selfish, this is the one bit of one and other. This is an interesting opportunity for me in that hour to be still and reflect on who is doing this and what their motivation is. Where are they coming?
Can I ask you then perhaps a little bit about your work as a TV producer, and for you to perhaps mention some of the television programmes that you've worked on, or some of the experiences that have being part of your professional life?
Okay, well, I have worked in television for about 35 years, and I began at Bristol University in the what was then the Radio, Film and Television Unit, doing a postgraduate certificate in Radio, Film and Television. And I would like the name of George Brandt, my professor of film, to go down in history, because he was a great man. The only man who can rip the gear lever off a car whilst it's in motion on the way to a location. I shall always remember him. Thank you, George. I made some friends there. I made some films there about squatters and about adventure playgrounds. Then I went to work, I did some things in theatre, and then I went to work for Granada Television, where even now upstairs maybe Stuart Prebble, who used to work at World in Action for but now runs Liberty Bell, he was there at the same time. So I spent a lot of time at Granada doing all the sorts of things that one does, you know, in those way dear dead days of ITV when they produced everything. So I did the scoring on the Krypton Factor. I did afternoon television chat shows. I did country programs. I did documentaries. I did the whole nine yards of British television, mainly towards the end, working more in documentaries. Then I did work on a film. I was the associate producer on a film called City, which was about Manchester City Football Club in a glorious period of its life. It's usually confusing and fallible and tragic history, which was described at the time as the best film about football ever made. Well, I couldn't be the judge of that, but that was a notable one. I made some films about salmon fishing and about seal culling. I worked on general election coverage. The last one I did was the election in which Paddy Ashton was still the leader of the Liberal Party, and we, in order to get him to a location, we put him on the back of a motorbike, because you'll remember Paddy Ashton used to be in the Special Forces. So we put him on the back of a motorbike in central London to get to Northolt Aerodrome in time for a plane. Unfortunately, he had also to take his assistant on another motorbike who hadn't been in Special Forces and found it rather terrifying. All of these sorts of things in the course of a working life amusing, and Granada was a great place to work. Then I left that, and there's an interlude there in which I went to live in a meditation center, a different perspective, and then I came back to work as a freelance in television and other things, and since then I've made a number of films and series about the doctors in the village where Peak Practice is filmed, called The Real Peak Practice. I've made films about IVF and about human cloning, a very controversial subject. Most recently, a film about human cloning that was screened earlier this year and was subject to the front page of The Independent and a lot of fuss as a controversial subject. I've made films about Martha Gellhorn, the famous, she would hate me for saying, the famous former wife of Ernest Hemingway, because she was a fine writer and reporter. That was fascinating to do. So many things in the course of a lot of television, but also other things, theatre and so on. I left full-time television in order to do a lot of other things that you can't do when you're solely committed to one avenue.
Mm-hmm. And how did television making, in your experience, change over that period?
Well, hugely. When I started with film, the only television you could make was television in a studio or with an outside broadcast unit. But I can remember the first portable video recorders, which were really small suitcases, not tremendously portable. And very temperamental and hard to lace up the tape and so on and so forth. But I made some work with those very early portable video recorders, and some of that was shown, in fact, at Bristol City Museum, which is where the Banksy show is now on. 20 new ideas for Bristol, I think I contributed to, with an early video recording that was on a continuous loop. Boy, was that revolutionary stuff. So in terms of the technology, it was very different. And in terms of the organisational structure, there was ITV, there was BBC One, there was BBC Two. That's it. And so in order to work in broadcast television, one's opportunities are much more limited, although in some ways, certainly within ITV, much greater, because it still had its regional framework and you could go and work in many different companies. Granada, as one of the, I think perhaps, in all honesty, the greatest of the ITV companies, offered an enormous range of opportunities. And the technology changes continuously, of course. This was, a lot of it was studio-based television, but a lot of it was also 16mm film cameras out on location, doing whatever it might be, you know, documentaries, news reports, dramas, although I didn't work in drama. So there were many opportunities to work across, well, internationally. I spent a number of years working on a project about the history of television, which took me to Japan and Latin America and Europe and North America and so on. So ITV, in its pomp, produced programs that now it couldn't or doesn't. So that's a sad decline, brought about by regulatory change, technology push, ownership, all of these things. I think that all of those factors, in terms of someone who works within television or works in the media, well, changing technologies offer different opportunities. The internet, for example, with one another, is a revolutionary way of communicating artwork to anybody who cares to look, wherever they might be, and if it's archived effectively, I suppose, in perpetuity. Although we've yet to see whether the internet outlives the book. So the changing technology offers one opportunities to work in new and exciting ways and communicate with new audiences. I think in organizational structures, I'm not so sanguine about the survival of British television. British television's ability to produce good work, I think, is seriously challenged. Thank God for the BBC.
Okay. And now, going forwards for you, what's important for you in your life now?
My mother and father and their health. My sister, my partner, Isabel Morons, my friends, one of whom is with me today, Simon Slidders, the people I work with, the meditation teachers who I've been fortunate enough to be able to listen to, one's health, the opportunity to remain open and curious to the world.
Is there anything else that you would like to add about being here today, about yourself, or about taking part in this work?
I would like to thank all of the team here at One Another who have been great, and that's been a heartwarming thing to come all the way from Herefordshire to meet beautiful people in this temporary structure. I would like to thank, obviously, Anthony Gormley for having the balls and brilliance to think and push through this project, and all of the people who are helping it, and wish them all, whether they have plinthed or are about to plinth, the very best of luck.
Oh, yes, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.